Hey there, this is Seth Juarez from Channel 9 coming to you from the beautiful city of Sandusky, Ohio for Codemash 2017. I say beautiful, and I put that in air quotes because it is ugly outside today. It's a little rainy, isn't it?
Well, it's a little gray.
Yeah.
We're not used to that in California.
No. So tell us who you are and what you do, my friend.
My name is Nuri Halperin. I develop code. I teach people how to use code, and I lead teams doing code projects and stuff like that.
So I thought today we would talk a little bit about MongoDB. This is something that...
I'm also a Mongo master.
Oh. Do you have like a t-shirt? Masters have like Mongo master t-shirts?
Actually, I do.
Oh, nice. I need to find a way
but
to
I don't
become
wear
a
it.
Mongo master.
I don't wear it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about, like, for those that don't know what MongoDB is, what is it? Why should someone look at it?
Well, MongoDB is a database. So if you have data and you want to store it somewhere, MongoDB is an option. It belongs to a class that is been built NoSQL, so it's not SQL, and you don't really address it with SQL syntax. But it's a database, and it scales massively. It scales linearly, which means when you have petabytes of data, you can just add more machines to the mix. And by using a technology called sharding, you can scale out your database massively and handle more writes and more reads or whatever mixture you need.
Awesome.
It's also not terribly structured. It really is flexible about letting you store the data the way you want to interact with it, rather flattened into tables and normalized according to some book. It's really up to you to come up with a schema that serves you. So I would say it's really the database that's about you as a developer. Like, how do you want to access the data? How do you want to store it? And it just serves you and gives you rich syntax to access, to query, to store, to modify, all of these kind of things.
So here's a question. I've had this question for a while, and it's something that I haven't been able to resolve for myself. Like, I have a hard time, because I come from the relational theory. I mean, I taught it in school. I went to relational theory. It was something I learned about in grad school a lot. I did all the math and stuff. And I understand now that relational theory was designed because you wanted to save space, right? And then when you moved forward, now we have so much space, it doesn't, the constraints aren't really necessary there. But I always had a hard time knowing how to sort of model these domains. How do I save these things? Like, what constitutes a record for me in a document database like MongoDB? How do I draw those distinctions?
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily say that relational databases were designed to save space. They were designed with safety of model first. So the idea that if there's an address and there's a person and there's a relationship between the address and the person, oh, by God, I don't want somebody to just delete the address willy-nilly because the person has this relationship to this address. So they were designed to make sure that your data is safe and also to give you what was considered then ultimate flexibility to come at the system from a different perspective, right? Maybe I want to do addresses and I want to check how many people live there, versus maybe I want to go from the people perspective and say, well, how many addresses are they associated with and for what? A work address, a home address, blah, blah, blah. Or maybe I want to come from the order, that, you know, my customer orders, and I want to see what addresses I ship to. So, you know, in a relational model, the model tries to be everything for everybody. And that poses some challenges. And the challenges of how should I model the data still exist.
Right.
However, with Mongo, what you get to do as a developer is make up your mind in some way and just tell the database, just save it this way. This is the way I want to see it. I don't want to translate into tables in relation, like give you a document, right? So now imagine an invoice, right? An invoice invariably includes a person that, you know, wants to make the purchase and a list of items and some summary of the money and some maybe information about if it shipped and where it shipped and stuff like that, right? Relational model will have me scatter it across seven tables, right? I need the line items to each be in some table of line items, and they're related to SKUs, and those SKUs now relate to some inventory system that describes what the SKU is. And all of that is kind of, you know, scattering all of that. The truth is, for you, you just want to see one document that is the invoice. And you want to see it today, and you want to see it 10 years from now. So once I created an invoice, and the sale is fulfilled, this is the invoice. The invoice is not a row that happens to have ID 1 from the person table, and a row that happens to have ID 1023 in the address, and a row that happens to have SKU ABC and some other reference, right? Your document is this. So why not just model it thusly, right? If we had database that supported our syntax to just save the document, and then you want to change the quantity on line 3, yeah, update invoice, where invoice ID is, you know, A23, mm-hmm. and set line items sub 03 to some quantity, right? So if you have the surgical update capability with rich syntax, why would you scatter all this data all around, right? So why wouldn't you look
that way? I understand, like I totally understand that, and it makes complete sense. But how do I establish like what a boundary is? Like I understand with an invoice, you have an invoice and it's gonna have sub order lines and maybe a summary and et cetera. But how do I go about modeling that properly in such a way that it makes sense, right? Because what if there's some other thing that needs to be in there? Like, do I need to store the customer and all their addresses in there? Or should that be a separate entity, for example? I don't know if they're called entities, but a separate document, for example.
Sure.
So how do I know where that boundary is?
Yeah. So know is a strong word. Knows assumes some universal truth. There's some guidelines that are evolving and that we are discovering.
Sure.
For instance, we know that for a document to contain an array, a list of things is okay when it's bound growth or small. Now what's small? Could it be 100 addresses? Yes. But a list of tweets in response to Ashton Kutcher's tweets or to some political figure, you know, that can grow forever. So that's unbound growth. So we don't want to store it in one document for two reasons. One, the document may get extremely large and therefore inefficient.
Sure.
And the second is that each time you write, it has an I/O cost of updating the whole document.
Sure.
So the rule of thumb for me is if entities have their independent lifetime, then I want to separate them. But objects that work together live together. So an invoice, back to that classic example, because, well, it's ubiquitous, a lot of you modeled that. You know, the line items belong in it. Now, can the invoice contain 100 lines or 100,000 lines, even once or something? Yeah, maybe, but we're not going to just keep the invoice and then over time add more and more and more lines, right?
No, once it's written, what it is.
Right, it is what it is. You wrote it once, you wrote it 10 times, and that's about it, right? Yeah. So by the time you're done, it's not unbound growth. So it's okay to let that document contain those items. Mm-hmm. Tweets, probably not, right? Social media commentary might maybe have their own entity. And then there's hybrid solutions. I can say, you know what? In my stream of posts on, say, some company with a blue logo or whatever, you know, I may want to see summaries, right? So I can create the main post, the tweets, and attach to them a limited list of the most common items. So I can, in one shot, get a document that contains that. And if somebody is interested and see more, well, then I'm going to query the big list of all possible tweets that are related to this by ID or something like that. So hybriding that also is a no-no in the relational world. What do you mean you're going to store comments here and here? Yeah. Or what do you mean you're going to embed, you know, a person's name in the invoice? What if they change their name? So it was Diddy and now it's P. Diddy. Come on.
No.
Right? So update all of the prolific poster that did 1,000, 10,000 lifetime posts. Issue a command saying, wherever you find this guy, update the name, and done, right? So we used to fear that with relational. No, we have to have just one place where it's all at. And now we duplicate data a little more loosely, responsibly. And when we need to address this change, we know that we have to apply it not only to the original entity of record, also to the ancillary. Okay, so that's a small price for me to pay because now my application rocks and the, you know, performance screams. So to me, that's a small price to pay.
So the question I have then is, where do I put the person? Is the person in the invoice? Would they be a separate document? And then why would you do either or? You see what I'm saying? Because that's where, like, the invoice makes perfect sense. But then when it has to do with, like, it's Seth's invoice, what am I storing in the invoice? What am I storing in a separate sort of document for the person? Or are they the same thing? What do you think?
So it depends is the right answer.
Of course.
And what I would say is, look, if a person has their own lifetime, meaning they registered at some point, and they may have some star rating, so they have their own independent interaction outside of invoicing. Maybe they're a good member but never shop, right?
Right.
So I need this own entity. But then for the purpose of invoices, I can save the ID of the person and I can put in the first name and last name. Why? Because it just goes on the label. I don't need their star rating and all of that.
Maybe their address or whatever goes on
stuff,
the invoice.
Yeah, stuff that, the invoice sense. Needs copy over. And that gives me a nice feature. If ever I delete that person or if ever they moved, that didn't change my invoice, right? Because it's embedded there. But wait, there's more.
Okay.
If you wanted to go back in time or use MongoDB 3.4 that just released, they have a feature called a dollar lookup. So up until fairly recently, once a document lives in a collection, there is no relationship, no connection, no nothing, nothing you can do to query another collection at the same time. You basically have to read one, read two. Now with the aggregation framework, I can look into the collection of invoices and merge in data from the person table correlated by ID. So there is this kind of join-like syntax that lets you pull in extra information from a separate collection in the same database.
Got it.
So now you get some of this relational niceness that if you really wanted to just have a pointer to the person in the invoice, you could. I would still argue that you want to do it judiciously, right? Because of historic records, right? So what if somebody changed SKU ABC123, used to be slippers, and now it's a bicycle? I look at an invoice from 10 years ago, somebody bought slippers, but now it's a bicycle. I do a query real time, and it misses it because it wasn't really a unique ID or something. So you want to be careful about historical records, and also to have that nicety of pulling a document in one shot, really, you know, one page click, one shot, one query. It's kind of nice, just copy over extra data. Data's cheap, disk is cheap, do it.
And that's an interesting sort of perspective that maybe I hadn't understood or heard. Effectively, what you're saying is look at the life cycle of the actual document, number one, because a person's life cycle is very different than an invoice life cycle. But if they are related, just copy over the data that is essential to the life cycle of the other document, and then just use that. And you're saying that the pushback would be, well, what if it changes? The answer is, well, you don't want to make the change because the invoice is a historical document that right. you would like to have.
Right.
Does that
and
make
my
sense?
My name was John Smith when I made the order a month ago, and now I changed to John Smith the Awesome. Mm-hmm. And you know, the reality is, a month ago I was just John Smith. Now I'm John Smith the Awesome.
Right.
So it's okay for the invoice to reflect old data
right.
sometimes. Right?
And that's okay. And in fact, it's okay. Probably even better, like in the bicycle example, you want to know that that's what they really, really bought.
Right.
It might be something.
So maybe I'll pull some description in as sure. described then
sure.
and stuff like that that was relevant then. And today it's changed. But guess what? I have this historical preservation.
Okay, so this makes a lot more sense. So I was hoping that maybe you could give us like a 5-minute overview of like, look, this is how you, now these the things you create are not tables, they're called collections. Is that right?
Right.
I wanted to see like what would it be like to actually new up a collection and put something in. Is that something you could show us?
I think so.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay, so first I need to be inside somewhere where it's Mongo. And Mongo, actually, there's zero installation options.
Right.
So I'll just look here. And the process called mongo.exe is the only thing you really, really need. That is the MongoDB
awesome.
Database.
Okay.
You copy that anywhere, you run it, you have yourself a Mongo database.
Got it.
Okay, so I'm going to start me a MongoDB database. And the philosophy is it should just work. Out of the box, the only thing you really need to tell Mongo is where the data is.
Right.
So I'm going to change directory to a temp directory here. And I'm going to make...
Let me fix this so you can see it. There you go.
I'm going to create me an empty directory called fresh.
Okay.
So I showed you that there's nothing in this fresh directory.
Okay.
So I'm going to start MongoD, which I'm going to launch it in a separate window. And I'm just going to say dash dash db path fresh. So I'm going to say, hey, store your data files there. It's a database, right? It's not a rinky-dink thing. So it needs to store the files persistent in a persistent way. So I'll start that, and that didn't work. That is probably because I'm in PowerShell, and PowerShell wants parameters elsewhere. So I'll do this, and it started a new server for me, and it's listening here on port 2707. So that's great. And now I'll start up a a Mongo shell, which is the administrative shell, and I'll just say Mongo.
And so this would be the client. The thing you just started was the backend.
Right. So this is the administrative
client.
That's like ISQLW or one of those things, right? So I'm connected, and it's warning me. And pay attention to this warning. It's saying, dude, you started a database, and there's no authentication. Please don't deploy it this way, right? We really want to set up some authentication and stuff, and it's fairly easy to do that. But don't go to production without setting up a username, password, and locking down ports and stuff like that. But anyway, words of warning.
Okay.
So I have, I'm in here, and show DBs tells me what databases I have. And in fact, I have just two, and they have nothing in them. So by default, it creates a local database to store some housekeeping stuff and admin to do admin stuff like users and stuff like that.
Got it.
So I want to use a database named CH9, maybe for channel 9.
Awesome.
Why
and
not?
And we have episodes and stuff in there.
So, dear diary, I now created a database.
Got it.
Right?
Would CH9 be a database, or would it where that holds multiple collections? Okay, good.
And so a database holds multiple collections, and the database I want to use is channel 9.
Got it.
Do you remember me going into the command line here and creating a database and all of that? Do you remember that part?
No, you just literally just said use it, right?
Yeah, yeah. So that's kind of nice about Mongo. And I type in DB, and it says, yes, you're in channel 9. I can say something like db.demo.insert, and I will create a document right here and then. And I will say ID is 1, and I'll say name is Seth.
And this is literally just like a JSON thing.
It's like a JSON thing. I like the way you said that. It's not actually JSON, it's BSON, which is a binary serialization notation. And BSON is more enhanced than JSON. It has rich data types. They have the C types for byte and word and int32 and 64 and a float and a decimal and an array and a datetime and stuff like that. So it understands fundamentally this stuff. In JSON, you have a string, an array, an object. And that's it.
Yeah,
right?
That's true.
So a number in JavaScript is a single data type. You don't have all of these
decimal and a. Yeah.
So in MongoDB internally, it has much more knowledge about this type system, and it stores things in a very efficient way.
And so literally that's it. You just say, because there was no collection called
there was no collection demo. Called demo, and I didn't say, oh, create me a collection demo, please. No, I just blurted out, hey, in a thing called demo, put that in. Now, if I wanted to, I could say define a collection for me. For instance, I might want to define a collection and predefine indexes on fields I know exist in there, or create a collection that is capped to a certain size, or do some stuff like that, so I can create it. But out of the box, hello world, dear diary, I created a collection. Hey, look, db.demo.find, and there you are. A document.
So if I add another document in there that has maybe a different structure, is that going to cause a problem, or does it have to always be the same structure in a collection?
No. So let's put an ID, a new document. I'll insert another one, and I'll have the ID of Marklar.
Okay.
And I'll put, instead of a name, I'll put a X with a value of 23, and a name that will be an array of a letter A and the number 42. Because every...
Of course, it's a magic number.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a magical place. So now what I did, and I pray to the god of close parentheses here, now what I did is I created another document. So let me clear this and let's find. So I have two documents in here. The only common thing to both is both of them have an ID, and that's in fact the cardinal rule of schema. Every document must have an ID.
Got it.
Period, end of story. The ID is the document in many senses. It's a handle to the document. Now, you will notice that the ID, although it has to exist, does not actually have to contain the same data type. Number one document there had an ID of one, which is a number, and the second one had a string ID. That's fine.
That's interesting.
It doesn't care.
Yeah.
Right?
That's amazing.
But it also knows. It knows that one of them is a string and one is a number. So for any comparison purposes, for any math purposes, for anything, it understands the data types, but it lets you specify them on the fly as you wish. Is this a recommended thing to do?
No,
not necessarily.
Not. Yeah.
But it's a flexibility that exists for the cases that you need it.
Right.
And you'll notice that, again, I played with a field name, mm-hmm. right? So one of them is an array. And in the array, it's a non-uniform array. Some of the items are numbers, some are this. And you can make them even records in curly braces that contain an address with a line one, line two, line three, zip code, da-da-da-da-da. So you can do all of that, have deeply nested documents. As long as you don't break the 16 megabyte limit for a document size,
which
you're good.
Which is quite big.
16 megabytes is a way for them to yell at you, dude,
that
way
seems
too
dumb.
Much.
Yeah.
So it used to be four. And then people were like, but I need the extra byte for my image. And like, okay, fine. But don't go too crazy. If you exceed a megabyte, I hope you know what you're doing.
I would never store an image in this. I would store a path to an image that's stored somewhere. I
mean, yeah.
I don't know. Would you store an image in there, or should I just like put it in some kind of blob storage and then put a path to it?
Like this, just as a property on a document? No, because it means each time I retrieve the document, I retrieve the whole fat image.
Right.
Maybe I just wanted the first name.
Yeah.
So there's ways to project out when I do a query and just say, hey, find me this document, but only give me the ID or the name.
I see.
So it could be. However, I wouldn't do it this way.
Yeah, I wouldn't do it.
But MongoDB has an interesting protocol kind of overlay that's called GridFS. That is purposely built to create files.
Got it.
And with GridFS, you can upload files into Mongo, and it splits it into chunks. So imagine you're maybe in the video business.
Mm-hmm.
Now your video is stored in, say, 256K chunks, and you can address it by saying, give me the whole thing, which will just stream to you all of those. Or you can retrieve a chunk at a time, which is great for streaming infrastructure.
Absolutely.
So there are ways to store binary images that will never be really manipulated by any operators other than created once.
Right.
So there's a way to do it in Mongo as well.
I see. So the last question, and so now my head's kind of like, okay, I understand. Now what I can do is I can use whatever library to store stuff in, C# or JavaScript or whatever, and it just sort of builds on top of this notion.
Yep.
Which is super simple.
Yep.
The last thing I wanted to ask you was, I've heard recently that there's been some security issues with Mongo, and I wanted to clarify, because sometimes, like, when I hear about security, most people think like they have some guy with like a mask that's like hacking into things, and generally I find that it's because you have a crappy password and use it everywhere. That's what really hacking means.
Yeah.
So tell me, what recently has been in the news about Mongo, and what really is the root cause, so people can understand?
So, as I showed you here, the Mongo binary can just run anywhere.
Right.
So, imagine you came from coding school and they just showed you how to create a mean stack application.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, yeah, it's easy. All you do is npm install and yaml mean and boom, you have an application. And you spent a lot of time in HTML and maybe some in JavaScript. But you really didn't know anything about Mongo. You know it used Mongo,
right. But
it got kind of just packaged for you. And now imagine you took this whole package thing, and then you copied it out to a cloud, and you just let it be this way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you didn't have a username password established because you didn't actually install Mongo, you just took a package that installed it for you, mm-hmm. you may not even have a password. So part of what we're hearing in the news is that people took MongoDB without really spending the time or ever accessing the shell, because you remember it gave us a warning,
yeah,
hey, dude, don't
do that.
Yeah, they didn't do that, probably,
uh-huh.
right? Either because they didn't understand or because they never saw it. Maybe they took a Docker container that had Mongo exposed on port 27017, put it in the cloud verbatim without closing that port, right?
No.
So a lot of these so-called hacks have to do with people deploying Mongo unsecure completely. And they do that sometimes because they haven't really done due diligence and locked it properly, but many times because they weren't even aware of shipping Mongo. They didn't necessarily learn computer science or anything. They didn't necessarily have work experience telling them about security best practices.
So the majority of the actual hacks was literally somebody found out that Mongo was running on that machine and there was no password, the port was completely open, and they just literally ripped all the data down.
Pretty much. So you have cache under the mattress, right? That's a weak password, but it's cache under the mattress. What they did is they took that wad of cache, went out their front door, put it on the curve, and said, I'm done. And now somebody came and collected $100 because they didn't do anything. They didn't even put it in the house. They didn't lock it down. They didn't do anything to protect that.
I see.
So they basically hung their dirty laundry outside. I mean, they didn't. It's not a hack against Mongo. It's not that they had a weak password. It's that they had no password.
So literally,
in many cases, it's just no password, or they have a password but they're not using SSL on the connection. Therefore, traffic can be listened to. There's a bunch of very, very simple things. In fact, I have there's a page on MongoDB website.
Let's move it over so people
can explain all of these things. And you can look on security. They have great explanations on all of the security options that are available.
People didn't look at that.
Probably not. I don't know who those people are.
Yeah.
Right? I'd love to get to them. I have a course on Pluralsight. I'd love for them to watch it. At least basic security, I'm speechless,
and
right?
This happened, and now that I understand.
It happened about a year ago. It got advertised, but still, folks fresh out of school or not at school at all, and I read on the interweb that it's easy to do Mongo.
Many years ago, I had a customer, and I think this is exactly the same problem. I had a customer that, for some reason, this company was hijacking. They had their data, and they wanted to move to software that I was going to build. They couldn't get it, and so I was going to start to screen scrape all their data out, but then I tried like a SQL injection, and it literally borked, and I found out when the error is an ODBC error. It turns out they were storing everything into Access database. The error told me the exact path where it was at. Their security measures were such that the database had to be able to read and write, and everyone could. Since it was on the internet, I literally went to the path and downloaded the Access database. Effectively, this same thing that I did is what people are doing with MongoDB now.
Yeah.
It's out there hanging out.
You can do a port scan, and it's not completely legal, certainly not ethical, but completely possible because they didn't take very, very basic steps. So when you go with a third party that hosts for you, hopefully they do the job for you.
Yeah.
But when you go with cheap route that just says, oh, here's a container, I read on the interweb, I just do this, and oh, I can't reach Mongo, so let me open that port, or it was open by definition, then you're really exposing your Mongo. Shame on you, and I feel pity for you, but I also look at you a little funny. I mean, the finger is pointed at you for not following basic steps. And I think there are ways to think about secure by default.
Uh-huh.
However, many of those issues crop up because secure by default implies somebody has to do something extra post-installation. And some of the packaging mechanisms, like here's a Docker container with mean already on it. Just copy your web pages in JavaScript and then just run it, done. You know, they don't let you access those things.
Got it.
It's not set up or other kind of, chef recipes or other things that install Mongo for you. And you're not really present there for the installation, knowledgeable to do those basic steps.
Well, Nuri, this has been super helpful. I love the discussion we had about collections, the boundary between collections, the ease with which you can actually create collections, and the way to think about, like, it's okay to duplicate data if that belongs in that scope or in that life cycle.
Yeah.
I love looking at the demo, it's super easy, and then the security talk was very helpful. So I helped clarify that it's not MongoDB, it's just sometimes we do dumb things as programmers.
Right, right.
And so
and the the cure to that is education, right?
Right.
So learn. Yeah. Don't just go out there and stick it out there and have your database hacked.
Yeah.
There you go.
Thanks so much, Nuri, for being with us. Thanks so much for watching. We're here at Inside Esky, Ohio for CodeMash 2017. My name is Seth Juarez. This is Channel 9. We'll see you next time. Take care.